This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Yanu, which in our language is hello. Mental blank. Nigaya Wulgi, Nigaya Wuinga Madigal, Maramarong, Tianaganaga, Maramarong Baialia, Ngunnawal Guri Pemul. Just paying my respects to be able to walk and talk in Ngunnawal land and advising you who I am. And that's my skin group. So I always try and start with the blue-eyed brother. Aboriginal economic development. I'm a little bit different in this presentation to the previous presentations. My research is about Aboriginal entrepreneurship. And thank you for the people that are here, that are still here. Quality rather than quantity. But I look at modernity, I look at the Aboriginal economic development now, and one of the things that always gets up my nose, and I think it upsets quite a few people, is the way the word Aboriginal economic development is bantered around and used in so many different ways. And I think I used in the abstract that it's like a band-aid on a tropical sore. It can be used for so many different applications, but without understanding where it's coming from. And it's a concept that, unfortunately, I think is misunderstood by the people who write policy, and I'll go through that a little bit more. My work's on urban. I look at the urban Aboriginal, and you'll soon see why. And it's incredible that policymakers who have control of our social well-being, I don't believe that they really understand us as a people, and they don't understand economic development for us. I'm sure they don't understand economic development in the rural remote, but they definitely don't understand economic development in the urban. So this is my story. So we've discussed economic development in homelands, dingo scalps, camels, all sorts of topics, hybridisation, which is a paper that I've always loved, and I've got a new word. Because my problem in my country is that when I talk about the Indigenous migrants, the migrants who have come into my country, and I'll show that in a minute, I refer to them as usurpers, and there are organisations, Aboriginal organisations in my own country who are usurpers. But the concept of Creole is rather new, and I read your paper last night, and it's actually exciting because a person who I admire a lot often refers to this new creation of culture, and it's a creation of culture from a business sense. And I think the idea of Creole actually covers it. So thank you very much for that paper. You'll be quoted. I want to introduce you to the new frontier. And you may think I'm crazy. In 1788, this was the original frontier. I believe it's the new frontier now. My people were invaded in 1788. They were also invaded in 1895. In 1895, we had a massive drought, went from 1895 to about 1902, and we were invaded by large groups of Aboriginal people who were outside of the Sydney region. Now, in the 1910s to 1920, we were invaded again, another invasion in 1920s, and then another invasion in the 1930s, 1950s, we had another economic invasion with the industrialisation, small business, requiring labour. A lot of Aboriginal people moved off the land, came to Sydney, and then we had another explosion in the 60s and 70s with the civil rights and the Indigenous land movement and everything else that stemmed out of Redfern. There is a lot more to Sydney than Redfern. And I see this as the new frontier, to understand these layers of Aboriginal invasion in a country where these are actually now migrant groups in a country that isn't theirs. And I do not believe that people like Native Title Services, the New South Wales Government and the Department of Aboriginal Affairs have got no idea, particularly when they have legislation such as the New South Wales Land Rights 1983 as amended, they have no idea about the implications, particularly when it comes to economic development for either traditional owners or the new people that have come in, the new migrants who are Aboriginal. They're not Aboriginal for that area, and yet we get bundled together that we're all the same people. We are not. And that's one of the big problems about economic development. We're all put in the same basket, the same community, but unfortunately it's different. I'll quote Helen Hughes. Now, this is a quote from Convenience. I don't necessarily agree with her politics, but some of the stuff she writes fits into what I write, so therefore I don't know whether I'm right-wing, left-wing, or just crazy. But she has a simplification of the Aboriginal population, and it's a pretty good one. She says there's 500,000 Aboriginal people, roughly. And of those, 160,000 live in urban middle class, and we have around about 250,000 who live below the poverty line in urban, and we have about 90,000 in rural remote. Now, I do not research the rural remote, and I categorically state that. So that's for other experts. I stick with the poverty in the urban area and the middle class urban. They're my research base. So I've got a base to look at really of around about, 410,000 people that I look at. So it gives you an idea where my research is based. Now, if we roughly look at Hughes, page 3, the publication 2008, 160,000 working in jobs in cities and towns and countries, relatively well-educated, providing a wide range of occupations. Now, think about that, and think about this population prior to the 1970s. The middle-class Aboriginal population prior to the 1970s was much smaller. So we've had this huge jump, and a lot of that's because of public service employment. That is not because of entrepreneurial activity. It's from other things. It's the growth in the public servant, growth in education, growth in Aboriginal industries. And that's what's exciting and interesting about these figures when you start to analyse it. Proud of their culture, enjoy mainstream living standards, participate in Australia, and their children have educational opportunities on par with suburban middle-class Australia. We are starting to build up human capital, because prior to the 70s, in my life, when I was a junior, I was expected only to go to intermediate. Why? Because a black fellow is only good enough to be a labourer or work in a factory. And that's why. We didn't have human capital. Now we're building human capital. We're coming into some exciting times. The other one that's really interesting, 250,000 people that are in poverty areas, on the fringes of towns, cities, metropolitan city ghettos, you know, the public housing system, etc. This is where I came from. And this is why this interests me as well, because the concept of entrepreneurial development in this area has the most striking impact. And you can see that the children have poor access to education opportunities. They will always remain on the poverty line unless we can increase that education. Because entrepreneurial activity, successful entrepreneurs, and I've looked at, examined around about 600 Aboriginal successful entrepreneurs, and in around about 70-odd percent of those cases, they have tertiary education or trade qualifications, one of those two. So there is a link between education and entrepreneurial success. 90,000 also homelands, and I won't go into there. I think we all agree with that. We have some wonderful homelands in Sydney. If I went back that slide, they're called Mount Druitt, St Mary's and Campbelltown. Should you ever want to do some research there, which are under-researched. We just don't know what goes in those areas. As I said, Hughes generalises. However, she paints a basic picture. Now, my argument is if 82% of our population are living in the urban area, why is the majority of research being done in the bush? Now, I'm not saying we should do less research in the bush. I'm saying, please, more people come. Please help us do some more in the city so we can understand exactly what's going on, because we don't really know, as I said before. Now, I argue, how can policy be informed if it's concentrated and stereotyped and ill-informed? And this is exactly what's happening today. And the more I get involved in government departments or other agencies, the more I realise that I'm talking to people who are ill-informed, because they're looking at stuff that's written and written correctly in outback situations, but it's not applicable to the urban situation. And there's a wonderful paper at CAPER on their discussion paper series called We're Not All Communities and We're Not All in the Outback. I think it was written about 2002. But it's on the web there, you can go to it. But it is the case. We're not all communities and we're not all community-based and we're not all in the Outback. And this is a quote from Warren Mundine. It's actually wrong. He was incorrect when he quoted it. But it sort of sets the scene for the population differences, that there's more Indigenous Australians living in the Sydney urban region than in the entire Northern Territory. He's actually wrong. It's actually New South Wales than the Northern Territory. But anyway, there's two types of entrepreneurs. This is what I really want to talk about, and this is why I think the paper was selected. There's two types of entrepreneurs. They're called the push or the pull entrepreneur, and this fits Aboriginal Australia perfectly. Now, the opportunist or necessity entrepreneur is another definition, and that's the definition that I like. The opportunity entrepreneur has access to social capital, has access to financial capital, has access to business experience and knows what they're doing. I am yet to find a new start Aboriginal entrepreneur who's an opportunist. What I have found is necessity entrepreneurs, and they come from those two specific regions that Hughes calls the urban poverty and also the middle class. That's where the majority of our necessity entrepreneurs come from. And my work over the last 10 to 15 years has concentrated, as I said before, on that urban. And then nearly all necessity. I say nearly all because maybe there was one that slipped through, but one or two. But I have yet to see a new start or a nascent entrepreneur who was an opportunist. Now, the majority come from the middle class area due to the change in employment. The classic example is teachers, people in the public service who have found themselves in a dead-end job, a position going nowhere, or they find themselves unemployed or retrenched and they get out of it. And I'm a classic example. I found myself, I've worked in some of the worst industries. I was a soldier, then I was a public servant, and then I worked in the banking industry. And when I was in the... And I ended up in academia, my goodness. It's all downhill. But one of the interesting things is that when I was in the finance industry, because I had no qualifications, I was retrenched several times. And I found myself to be a necessity entrepreneur. I actually started a couple of businesses up. Some were successful, some were broke, and that's why I'm in academia. But it's an interesting area, these people in the middle-class areas who don't have enough financial capital to keep them going to get reskilled or retrained in another area, are re-employed, and they look at business as an alternative. But the one that's really exciting is the upper percentile of the 250,000, which is half of our population, and that's what you've got to bear in mind, those stats. Half of our population, the upper percentile of those who can scratch together some seed capital. And invariably, it's a little bit of savings, it's some savings, beg and borrow here and there, and it's a credit card. We start businesses in Australia, we being Aboriginal, on a credit start-up around about $6,000, which is much less than the average non-Indigenous person starting up a business. That is not much money when you think $5,000 has probably come from the credit card. And then the working capital through the life cycle of that business, for the first few years, credit cards are used extensively for your working capital, pay for wages at Christmas or pay for the bills, etc. So that's which makes us a little bit different to the non-Indigenous person. And this is some of the things we need to understand more about. We need to understand and have policies and financial packages, etc., that can help our startup entrepreneurs become more successful, have better stats and better lifestyles. The transition from poverty, welfare dependency to income earning financial independence. Financial independence is a key word that I use often, and I'll come back to that again. Necessity entrepreneurs, they show a profound lack of social capital. My research over all these years, and we mentioned social capital before, the word social capital is a very slippery terminology. A lot of people apply it to suit lots of different things, but social capital from the management perspective that I'm looking at is associated with family connections, the business connections within a family, business expertise, your skills in venture capital fundraising. Well, obviously we haven't got much because we use a credit card. Just your general business knowledge, it's not there. If you compare the Aboriginal startup with, say, the Greek or Italian first generation coming to Australia, and you go back for the Greek or Italian migrant that's come here, or the Vietnamese migrant is another interesting comparison, there is a depth of knowledge, of business knowledge, that they can draw on through their family over, you know, many generations. Aboriginal Australia, because of the way we've been penned, cut off from our family, you know the stories, you research it, you study it, you know, the way we've been treated with colonisation, we do not have the social capital. And that's one of the biggest problems when people provide policy to understand us and to help us financially in economic development. You've got to go back to the very roots and look at the development of social capital. Look at the education. And that's why the successful entrepreneurs, as I said before, 70% of them, you know, we've got tertiary education or we've got trade qualifications. One of the other things we don't have, and the scary thing, is we do not have Indigenous business mentors or role models as such. It's getting better, but by and large, when I started, it just wasn't there. So the result is a profound reliance on the dominant culture. When an Indigenous entrepreneur goes into business, there is no population size and density that supports them, and we can't apply ethnic theory, co-cultural theories, ethnic enclave theories. They don't work, and I refer to Roger Waldinger, Lynn Rosenthal, and heaps of other people. It doesn't happen. It sort of happens in some areas, but the population size isn't enough, so it's a whole new ballgame. The result is a profound reliance on dominant culture. And this is another thing. In the urban environment, if you are a successful Indigenous entrepreneur, you will at some time in your business life be totally reliant on that dominant culture. Okay. Due to the small scattered Indigenous population, as you can see, the business finance, as I said before, the business finance comes from creditors that are non-Indigenous, and all our sales invariably are non-Indigenous as well. Otherwise, it's the cars coming in wanting something for free. And that's also a problem with our businesses. Any mentors or business supporters are also non-Aboriginal, by and by. And we're totally dependent there. And interesting, if you're not in the hospitality industry, quite often you do not identify as an Aboriginal. And that's a scary part, which is the concept of racism or the new buzzword, social inclusion. The concepts of social inclusion for Indigenous people in business is very, very bleak. That's the point I want to cross. Look, as I said, I'll repeat again, the cultural, social and financial environment is very important to understand for people. The urban Aboriginal entrepreneur is a member of a community, however, their business is based on commercial capitalist models. And that's what we need to understand, because we're in the dominant society, we need to understand that model, and we need to understand how that model will work for Indigenous people. The nuclear family is the intrinsic motivator in the first instance, the wider family comes later, particularly as the business grows and as they become more successful. The future, this is the first time in my life I've ever praised IBA. IBA have kicked a few goals lately, I'm very proud to see. So please, if you know anyone in IBA, tell them that I said a nice word about them. IBA has done some good things. And there's a couple of people who have been outstanding as Aboriginal role models. One is Mr. John Moriarty, and the other one is Mr. Flick, who recently passed away, so I won't say his Christian name. Worked tirelessly in the community to help new start Aboriginal entrepreneurs. And there are more people like them right around Australia, male and female. There's a lady in the Northern Territory who's just dynamic, who are helping young people grow. Eric Wilmot, it's a breath of fresh air for old fellas like me who are getting close to their grave, close to retirement, to finally see some young people come through. There's a young lady up at James Cook Uni who's doing research on Torres Strait Islanders, and we've got Eric Wilmot shaking the can there, and I hope I spelled his name right, shaking the can in Brisbane. Dynamic, great. There's a future out there. And they're really getting into government. They're making people sit up and listen. The future. Remember I said about financial independence? Self-determination for Aboriginal people can be achieved by financial independence. Now, that's for the middle class and that's for the people in the poverty level, that half of our population. If we can achieve financial independence, we have self-determination. And I think that can be applied anywhere around Australia for all minority groups, not only Aboriginal, but for anyone. But we need to develop the social capital and education structures, and we need to understand those before it can work. And that's the 250,000 I keep harping about them. They're the people we've got to bring up. And entrepreneurship is not for everyone. It's not, it shouldn't be rammed down Aboriginal throats. But when it does work, it is fantastic, because the domino effect, time and time again, you see families where, there may be five, but then all of a sudden it ripples and there's 10, 15, 20. There's so many people who benefit because one person has been successful in business. The family builds and the family grows. More people get involved in education. More people get involved in business or have a job. Thank you. Now, we're active in all sorts of areas: building, engineering, hospitality, tourism, of course, land development, natural resource management. The list is endless. Architects, motivational consultants, educational analysts, design consortiums, even financial planning, where we're not supposed to be able to count, or add up money, the things. We're no longer just boomerang makers. We are really, really getting in some great areas. However, I repeat, policymakers need to understand. The future, however, is positive if we work together, and sarcastically I say, on the new frontier, because it's in the large urban areas where our population is and where our population is misunderstood, that is where we can have the most impact. And it's people like you. We need non-Indigenous people to research us, but research us and hold a hand, and not hold a hand to come up, but hold a hand in unity, and we can be successful. Thank you. Te kere go.
Thank you, Dennis. Questions? John?
Oh, no, I say.
Thanks, Dennis. John Altman. Look, just three really brief comments that you might like to respond to. With social capital, do you think it might be useful for you to differentiate bonding from bridging social capital? On differentiating bonding from bridging social capital. Take that one on notice. Mm. Are you telling us about entrepreneurship or about Indigenous self-employed, and is there a distinction? And I guess the question that I really would be interested to you to speculate on is, you've told us a lot about the comparative disadvantage of indigeneity. Could you tell us something about the comparative advantage of indigeneity?
Well, the social capital one is an involved one, and I'd love to talk to you at more, and I don't think I can answer it now on my toes. The one about enterprise as against entrepreneurship. If you look at self-employed. Every Indigenous person who goes in a business, and in fact my definition of what is an Aboriginal entrepreneur, talks about breaking the social norms. And I believe that there is a period in their business life when they are actual entrepreneurial, when they break out of that social norm. Now, if they continue in, say, it's a corner store, and they stay in that corner store and don't do anything else, well, they're no longer entrepreneurial. But for the one little period when they broke out, they were entrepreneurial. It's when they develop new products and they look at different things, they diversify, and they maintain an entrepreneurial area, such as John Moriarty. He's all over the place, different businesses, very entrepreneurial. That's when they maintain their entrepreneurship. But it's that step up from one level to another level in a different area of commerce. And I argue it's not un-Aboriginal. And that's the main thing that I want to reinforce. It's not un-Aboriginal. We can talk about entrepreneurship pre-contact in some areas, and we can argue that. But, it's so at one stage they are entrepreneurial. Third question was? The comparative advantage of indigeneity really is in the hospitality industry, and that's when it is an advantage, when you can sell it, and when you can sell it properly. But you've got to break down the stereotypes. You've got to break down those stereotypes. And one of the great things that that we do very well is provide a product, but be there on time. You know, make sure you're 110% service orientated. That's when it works. And if you look at the successful operators, particularly up around Hopevale, the tourist operators up there, I'm trying to think of the name of the guy and I can't think of it. The guy, Judith Bennett's his business manager. Look, there's just so many stories all around Australia where tourism in the last 10 years has really bloomed. And obviously the Aboriginality is usually the advantage. But if you are in the motor vehicle industry, you do not put up your flag, trust me. Or if you're in the building industry, because the rednecks out there will chop you down straight away. And there's classic examples, and if I've got a little bit of time, there's a guy in Sydney a few years ago. He won a small business award, and all of a sudden, he'd been established in business for 25 years. All of a sudden, everyone knew he was Aboriginal. His business nosedived in 6 months. He was almost broke. And then he just had to lay low and then slowly build his business up. He was a smash repairer. Because all of a sudden people, and one paint company put his account from 60 days down to 45 to 30 to 14 and then to COD. Why? It wasn't because he wasn't a bad businessman, but because all of a sudden people found out he was a black fella. That's my correlation. So we've got to be very careful if you are in business. Some of the most successful entrepreneurs I've met in the building industry and in the motor vehicle industry hide their Aboriginal. They're just a dark-skinned Australian. So that is a real problem we have, and that's the concept of social inclusion. It is a big problem out there, racism. You know? Yeah. I hope I answered that one. One more.
Hi, Dennis. The House of Reps committee recommended the Indigenous Minority Business Council, which has just been announced in the last little while. Do you think that will have an impact, and if so, why?
I've got a lot of faith in it. Not so much in the structure that they're talking about, but the structure that is Aboriginal-driven. You can see on my shirt, I carry Mundura, Hunter Valley, Chamber of Commerce. I'm a director of an Aboriginal Chamber of Commerce. It's now gone statewide, and we actually hope to take it nationwide one day. And we were quite surprised by that recommendation coming out, because we're doing it ourselves from an Aboriginal position, and we're driving it ourselves without a government interference, without a bureaucracy. And it's very effective. It's very, very effective. Because all of a sudden, the concept of self-determination, we've got an Aboriginal organisation helping other Aboriginal businesses, and that's where strength and that's where self-identity. And the interesting thing is we've got a lot of non-Indigenous businesses wanting to come in and join us. So you can see there is a groundswell strength there, but it's driven from grassroots, and that's what's exciting. All these individual businesses, who are looking together as a national or a state organisation now, and we're hopefully looking as a national organisation, and that's where we will be a little bit different. So, yeah, I applaud their decision. I think the decision's great, but it depends on who they appoint, who's going to run it, how it's going to impact on us, and is it just going to be another bureaucracy? If it is, well, it won't work. But if it's grassroots-driven, yeah, I think it's got a lot of legs. It's got a good chance of success.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.